Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. Ooh, that's a little hot. All right. Also, after the debate, we've talked about the idea of me staying around and doing a Q&A. So I want to encourage you that if you hear anything this morning that you would like to push back against, that you need clarification on, I encourage you to come to the debate and then stick around afterwards to challenge me. I like challenge. I want the views that I express to be good. I want the ideas to be strong. And the only way that we find out if those are strong or good is for people to have the opportunity to push back against them. And so I welcome that if you want to come tonight after the debate for you to have the opportunity to raise any questions or challenges that you might have. A few weeks ago, I was in Tennessee. I was in the Chattanooga area. We were filming a television show that a production company has come along and done about what we do. And part of that filming, they took us to a place called the National Memorial for the Unborn. It's a small house in Tennessee that used to be an abortion facility. Thousands of abortions were performed there. It was bought out by a local businessman. He had the abortion facility torn down, and he rebuilt this house. And inside the house, there's a chapel area, a small chapel area. There's a garden that's a memorial garden. There's another garden that's there just for women, as for a testimony to their struggle and pain that they have. And when you walk in to the chapel area, there's a wall. And on the back wall, there's little plaques all up and down the wall. And each one of the plaques has been bought by somebody that wanted to participate in this memorializing of abortion in our country. And they all say different things. I mean, they're from different people. They're from women that have had abortions that are struggling with a pain from a past abortion. They're from men that encouraged women to get abortions. They're from nurses that participated in the abortion industry. They're from doctors that used to perform abortions and now regret it. And they put their regrets up on this wall. And then there's this ledge. And on the ledge, there are letters and cards and stuffed animals, and people have come. And as I was walking and looking at all of these things, I remember picking up one, and it was a letter from a teenage girl who had just found out that her mother had had an abortion before she had her when she was a teenager. And she wrote this letter to her unborn sibling, who she'll never know. And in this letter, she says, you know, I never knew you even existed until recently. And then through it, you just see this pain and heartbreak as she's talking about how mom is better now. And she regrets what she did to you every day of her life. And I wish I could have known you. And I know that I will know you someday on the other side. And then there's another that was a bill. It was actually a bill from an abortion procedure. And on this bill, he's redacted the names, obviously, which is a good thing. But he's left a message to the unborn child that was aborted that day. And in that message, he says, I am not your father, but I took your mother to the abortion facility because she was my girlfriend and because that was her previous boyfriend. You were her previous boyfriend's child. And he said, I'm so sorry, but I was afraid. I was afraid if she had the child, she would get back together with the father. And I didn't want to lose her. And so fear drove me to encourage her to go and do this. And you should have had the right to know your father. You should have had the right to know your mother. And I am so sorry for what I did. And all along this ledge, there's messages and letters and all of these teddy bears and different things that people put, is outpouring emotion from people all over the country who have driven there because they want to express the remorse and pain for what's going on. And here's the thing that struck me as I was in this room. If the unborn are not valuable in the same way that you and I are, if we do not have the same duties and obligations to them that we have to any other human being, especially the basic duty to just not kill them, if they don't have value, if they're not like us in morally important ways, then this building, this outpouring of emotion, this regret, all of this pain, everything that we're seeing associated with this memorial to the unborn is utterly and completely bizarre. It's weird. It's strange to see people struggling emotionally with something if they don't matter. Further, if they don't matter, people like me and what I do for a living, it is immoral. Because I travel around the United States and the world talking to people about an issue, raising up their awareness, getting them active and involved in something that if they don't matter has no greater moral component than a tooth extraction. And massive organizations like the Catholic Church, institutions that have world power are interfering with the free choices that women have to make about their own private medical decisions all over the world, with well-meaning and ideologically driven people like me contributing to the cause. And it affects everything.
It affects everything in our culture. Presidential elections, legislative elections, both nationally and locally, Supreme Court nominations, charitable giving. There's almost no aspect of your life that isn't touched by this issue, whether you realize it or not. Oftentimes in the last couple of years, behind the scenes, the political wranglings that you see that blow up into these massive, nasty fights are driven by the issue that we're discussing today, the issue of abortion. They just don't make that public because they don't want that to become the reason that starts to divide people on that political issue. There is no escaping it. And it's not just here in the United States. We have invitations as an organization to speak at over 22 nations around the world. I've spoken in New Zealand and Indonesia. We've spoken in South Korea. We speak in London twice a year. We go to England. Russia has invited us. We have people going into China. All over the world, they are wrestling with this issue. And if they don't matter, if they have no value, then I'm not just wrong. Then what I'm doing is by definition immoral. Women should be free to make those choices without interference by me or the community or anybody else in those decisions. If they don't matter, I'm deeply wrong. But if they do matter, if they have the same value that you and I do, if the unborn, we have basic obligations to them, not the least of which is just not to kill them, then what we see at that memorial, that little house, with all of those plaques, all of those teddy bears, all of those letters, that outpouring of regret and emotion, all of the work of those massive institutions I just mentioned, all of the things that I do, every effort by every pregnancy center all over this country, all of it is completely and utterly insufficient in the face of the injustice and the massive evil that abortion represents. If they matter, if they are human, if they are like us, then the world has never seen anything like this, ever. This is the destruction of a human life on a scale that we have never seen. In the United States alone, since 1973 and Roe v. Wade was enacted, there have been more than 56 million abortions in our nation alone. China, as of 2012, not current, not as of today, but as of 2012, released their numbers and their Ministry of Health of China. In China alone, since 1971 and the one-child policy was enacted, there have been more than 336 million abortions in China alone. Most of those, many of those, forced by the state against the will of their people. Take just those two numbers, just China and the United States since 1971. And that number is greater than the population of the United States and twice that of the entire continent of Australia combined. If they matter, we're talking about whole nations of human life wiped from the face of the earth through the practice of abortion. If they are valuable, we have lost more than 1 billion lives to abortion in the last 30 years worldwide. We have never seen anything like this, if they matter. This far eclipses the wars of the world. So we have to engage this issue. No matter which side you're on, pro-life, pro-choice, no matter where you stand on what they are, it is objectively important. It is not an issue that we can just set aside, but most of us don't want to talk about it. Most of us would rather just go away. The polling indicates that over and over again. We just want it to go away. Well, why is that? Why is there such an objectively important issue that we don't want to discuss? Because we're terrible at discussing it. It brings out the worst in us. It turns us into the worst versions of ourselves. I know I used to be a pro-choice atheist. I was on the other side of this when I was your age. And I saw how hot and heated pro-life people would get in these conversations and the horrible things that people who were supposedly representing the view that all human beings have value, the horrible things that they would do to support that position. It was dehumanizing to their opponents. And it came from both sides. Ugliness, rancor, madness, all of it. Over this one issue. I go all over the country and people say, Mr. Watts, I want to be able to talk about this. I want to be able to discuss this with my family, but I can't because every time I try to talk about it, we end up fighting. Even with the people that I love the most, it ends up becoming a fight. And so the easiest thing to do is just let it go and not talk about it at all. But obviously, the objective importance of the issue doesn't allow us to leave it alone. We have to engage it. So we just have to get better at engaging it. We have to get better at talking about it. And that's why my job exists. I suggest three things this morning to help us to get better at talking about it. Number one, that we simplify the issue. We simplify the issue by figuring out what is the core question of the abortion issue. The second thing that we're going to argue using science and philosophy, I'm going to be meeting later. with the Psalm 139 group, going to lunch with them. I am a unapologetically, passionately Christian gentleman, but I do not use my faith primarily when I go into an argument about abortion. I begin by arguing science and philosophy. And the last thing we're going to do is we're going to argue well. Hopefully, I'm going to argue in a way that honors Christ as an ambassador of Christ and honors the dignity and respect that I have for all human life, the whole foundation for which I'm arguing from. So we're going to simplify the issue, argue using science and philosophy, and argue charitably and well. How do we simplify the issue? We have to learn to focus on what is the core question that we're looking at. And when we're talking about the issue of abortion, I want to suggest to you today that it's not as morally complex as has been offered to us. Oftentimes, before I worked in ministry, when I just worked as an HVAC salesman, I remember I'd sit in the break room and these guys would say to me, this is such a morally complex issue, we'll never get to the bottom of it. There's such moral complexity to it. I want to suggest that there's not great moral complexity. There's sociological complexity to it, certainly. There's financial complexity and emotional complexity, deep emotional complexities for people that are going through crisis pregnancies. I agree to that. But the moral question is actually rather simple in the sense of what it is that we're trying to answer. The single most important question is, what are they? What are the unborn? Now, to demonstrate this, Greg Kochel, who runs an organization called Stand to Reason, he offers this illustration. He says, you imagine at your sink and you're washing dishes. So I'm at my sink and I'm washing dishes. My back is to the room. My focus is right here. And for the purposes of this, we'll use my 10-year-old daughter, MJ. She walks in behind me and she asks this question. Daddy, can I kill this? Can I kill this? It's a grim question. I mean, certainly it's not something you want to hear from your kid all the time, but when you have your own children, you'll find out you get a lot of weird questions from your kids. So it's not completely out of bounds either. So what do I need to do? What do I need to find out before I answer that question? What is it, right? That's an important question that has to be answered. What does she have? If it's a bug or an insect, I don't hate bugs or insects by any stretch of the imagination, but that's fine. Go ahead and kill them. Right now, I'm the only person in the house that can be relied upon to kill bugs. Even my 12-year-old son will call me when he sees a bug, which like a little part of my heart dies every time that he does it. But I'm like, yeah. He's like, hey, Daddy, there's a bug in the room. I'm like, oh gosh, son, man up. You know, what's the problem with you? My 5-year-old daughter, Nika, who was like a little force of nature, she did it for a while, but she was so ultra aggressive, we asked her to pull back. Because I'd be working in the room and the whole house would shake. And I'd hear Nika yell, got one, Daddy! You know, and at first you're like, sweet! But after a while, you're like, she's taking a little too much joy in this. So, no, yeah, sure, go ahead if it's a bug. If it's the neighbor's cat. I don't have a lot of time, so I don't want to go into detail. I don't hate cats, but I do hate this cat. And there's a lot of reasons why. I just don't have time to go into it. But even hating this cat, the answer is still no, because that would be really weird to tell my 10-year-old child to go ahead and kill the neighbor's cat. Not the least, which would probably affect my relationship with my neighbor when they came to me and like, have you seen my cat? And I'm like, yeah, I don't think you're going to see that cat again. But so no, if it's the neighbor's cat. If it's Nika, her little sister, or one of the neighbor kids, absolutely not. Let the kid go. What it is matters. And I can demonstrate this to anybody who drove here or has driven in the last couple of days. When I was driving up here last night, there was a point of Tennessee that I hit where some bug must have been reproducing because suddenly it just started exploding all over my windshield. And everybody here, driving from any one place to another, you are, I promise you, taking life on that drive. Something has died on your trip from one place to another. And most of us never consider it for a second. We never worry about all the bugs that are flying into our radiator, hitting our windshield. We never cry or weep over their death. It's just a part of our life that we don't even consider. But if you were driving here sometime last couple of days and you ran over a dog or a cat, you would feel differently. See, we have intuitions. I was speaking one time at Boston and this guy stood up in the back and he said, how do you know? How do you know there's a difference in the value of life? I said, well, I'm going to give you a philosophical argument to explain it, but we have basic intuitions and that's where we can start. By that, I mean that in addition to philosophical arguments that support our position, there's just a way that we understand the world to be working. Those are those intuitions that we have about things. And through that, we intuitively know that there's a difference in the values of those life. I said, walk into a Home Depot. I go to the home and garden section because I love working in my garden, especially before I have kids. I don't get as much time as I used to have. But I walk into the home and garden section. There's an entire wall that is dedicated to the eradication of garden pests. How to kill garden pests, insects, whatever, all of them. And there's a whole wall dedicated to it. And I have never seen anybody standing in front of that wall worried about it, upset about it. But as I said, if you ran over a dog on the way to school today, or when you were going out to Chick-fil-A or McDonald's or someplace local here, and somebody walked up to you and said, dude, you ran over a dog on the way, did you see that? You wouldn't be like, eh, who cares, and just move on, because you would understand there was something deeper about that. It would bother you a little bit more, just like if you're at Home Depot and you're standing in front of that wall, you're like, yeah, sure, kill garden pests. And then you look over to your left, and there's a whole new wall section that's been opened. That's the kill your neighbor's cats and dogs section. I assume you would look at that, and you'd be like, okay, something's going weird at Home Depot. Why does Home Depot want to help me kill my neighbor's cats and dogs? And I think that there would be moral trouble with that section. We would have a trouble with that, just as if the next section over was to kill your neighbor's section, it would be deeply troubling. You know, why does Home Depot want to help me kill my neighbors? What is going on here? It's strange, it's different. Just as if on any drive, on any day, a human child ran out in the road, and even if by total accident you killed it, it would be transformative. It would change your life from that point on. That day would never leave you. That moment would never be forgotten. It would always be a part of who you are. We intuitionally understand that there's just a difference in those lives, and we experience that firsthand. You don't need a PhD to tell you that. Now, we'll have philosophical arguments later, but just trusting our intuitions. They're not infallible. I'm not arguing that our intuitions tell us everything without error. But what I'm arguing is we have to start somewhere in our thinking process. And as we begin to think, we recognize that we experience that there's a difference in the value between insects, between cats and dogs and squirrels and things like that, and between human life. So what is it will determine what we can do with it. Until we answer that question, we can't determine what we're allowed to do. Now, I'll speak at college campuses, and we'll have debates like we'll be having tonight, and the other side will speak, and they will say things like this. Mr. Watts, abortion must remain legal to protect women's equality in the marketplace. Women must have equal access to success in the marketplace, and unless they have access to abortion, they can't have that. You see, men are unfairly influenced or affected by pregnancy in a way that men are not. I can run around getting women pregnant all over the place and they'll never affect me or impact me. But a woman, she gets pregnant and impacts every part of her life. And that's not fair. So in order to balance the field, women have to have access to abortion. Now she's making, or he, whoever's having that, is making the first mistake that we encounter when we talk about this issue. And I want to talk about a couple of mistakes that we make. The first one is that we already assume that the unborn are not human before we even start the conversation. And here's how I know that they are making that mistake. I don't discount anything that they have said as importance. I don't minimize the importance of those issues. I have two daughters whom I dearly love, who are brilliant, beautiful young ladies, and my only hope is that they grow up and have the opportunity to get anything that they want based on how hard they're willing to work for it and the talents that God gave them. And I don't want any artificial impediments to their success coming. But with the person that I'm talking to, use the justification that they just used for an abortion to justify killing somebody they uncontroversially accept as a human being. Would they say we should be allowed to kill two-year-olds to protect women's equality in the marketplace? Would they say that we should be allowed to kill 10-year-olds? Never. Not in any of the times that I've asked them that question. They would never say that. Why then do they say it's okay to kill the unborn? Because they've already assumed that the unborn aren't human in the same way that you and I are. But that's exactly what they have to demonstrate. And I tell them that. I say, look, I agree with you. I passionately want women to have equality in the work in the marketplace. I don't want women to have artificial impediments. But there are some things that morally we are not allowed to do to get ahead in this world. And one of those things is that we're not allowed to take other people's life. As Immanuel Kant said, human beings are an end in and of themselves. They are not a means to our ends. And so I cannot destroy their life in order for me to get ahead. So the question is, are they human life? Are they like us? I'm going to argue that they are. And you have to argue that they're not. You have to demonstrate using science and philosophy that they are something different. They're the kind of thing that we can kill. But you don't just get to assume it. You don't just get to say it and have that so. You have to argue why they're scientifically different from us or philosophically different from us, but you can't just assume it so. Nobody gets to assume. We both have to argue our case. See, and I see this all of the time. I was speaking at one place and a guy stood up in the back of the room, a faculty at a school out in the California area, and he says, "Mr. Watts, women have to have access to abortion to protect their right to privacy. Women have a right to privacy. They have the right to make private medical decisions without the interference of the state or the community or you." And I agree with him, by the way. I'm a private guy. I said, "I agree with you. Privacy is very important." And I use a tool we call Trot Out the Toddler. I said, "I agree with you. Privacy is important. As a matter of fact, it's what Roe v. Wade says. Roe v. Wade says that women have a right to privacy. It's the entire justification for the freedom to get abortions in the United States, a woman's right to privacy." I said, "But I have a 2-year-old little girl staying next to me. This 2-year-old little girl is my next door neighbor. Every night in the privacy of her own home, this little girl is viciously abused by her father. Her life is one humiliation after another, one episode of abuse after another in the privacy of their own home. The only time she has any release from this, the only time it relents at all, is when they're out in public and he has to curtail his behavior. Would it be okay with you if we removed this little girl in the house, violated the privacy of my next door neighbor's family, took this little girl out of that house to protect her from that abuse?" Well, he said, "Absolutely it would." So I asked this question, why? Why is that okay? It's a private matter for that family. It's happening in the privacy of their own home. Where do you or I or the community get off violating their privacy to go in there and take that girl out of their home? And he argued, and I went back and forth. I kept asking, why? And finally he said, "Privacy is not a justification for the abuse of human beings." And I said, "I agree with you. So if the unborn are human in the same way that this little girl is, then we should not use privacy as a justification for abusing them either. The question is a matter of privacy. We both accept that privacy is important. We also both accept that there are reasonable limits to privacy. The question is, what are they? Are they the kind of thing that we should not kill?" Until we answer that question, we can't even get to the discussion point of abortion as far as whether it's right or wrong. The second mistake that we make, other than assuming that the unborn are not human, is that we fall into a trap of relativism or subjectivism. And this is happening all over the United States. Everywhere you talk to people and you hear it like this. I remember a young lady standing up in San Francisco and she said, "Mr. Watts," she said, "if you don't like an abortion, then don't have one. If you don't like it, then don't participate in it." I said, "Okay, here's the problem. The key word in what you said there is like. I didn't say I don't like abortion. I'm arguing that abortion is wrong. And those are two entirely different things. Like is a question of preference. It's a subjective statement. If I tell you something about me that's subjective, I'm telling you something about the subject, me and my likes. I like bacon. I love bacon. I love apples. I love Reese's peanut butter cups. There's Coca-Cola, which I have right under here for me. I love all of these things. And I used to talk about more about my love for bacon than I do now, because surprisingly, after I would get done talking about abortion, a surprising number of people wanted to argue with me about bacon afterwards. And so I've dropped a lot of the talk about bacon. I had this one woman come up to me after a talk that I gave, and she said, "You should not eat bacon." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because pigs are smarter than dogs." I was like, "Oh, do you want me to eat dogs then?" And she gave me this nasty look. She's like, "That's not funny." I was like, "It's a little funny." But let's see. I love green apples. I love Granny Smith apples. My daughters love those red mushy apples. I think they're disgusting. They just disintegrate in your mouth. My love for green apples in no way obligates my daughters to like them. They can like their soft, mushy, disgusting apples, and I can love my awesome green apples. And those are differences between us as far as preferences. It's what I like, it's what they like, but my likes in no way obligate them to like them. But when I talk about abortion, I'm not saying I don't like it and then it falls into that realm. I'm saying this objectively wrong. An objectively moral fact is like an object in the sense that it exists outside of me, external to me. Like this lectern right here, this right here is an object. It existed when I didn't know about it. It existed when I got here. If I like it or don't like it, it is what it is, independent of how I feel about it or my knowledge about it. It has a reality outside of me. And when I say that abortion is wrong, I'm saying it's objectively wrong. And the same classification of other things that we would uncontroversially accept as wrong. We would, every person in this room, I hope, agree that rape is a great moral evil. That there is nothing funny about rape. that it is a great moral, and it's wrong for all people at all times, even though there are people out there called rapists that like rape. We would never, ever, as functioning moral people, think to say, well, rape is wrong for me, but that guy likes it, and so it must be okay for him. Because we understand that's objectively wrong for all people at all times. Abusing other human beings, child abuse, it's wrong for all people at all times. We would never say that guy likes to beat his 2-year-old child, so he should be free to do so. I will personally choose not to do so. You see, uncontroversially, we accept those as objective moral facts. So when I start to say things like abortion is wrong, I'm arguing that it's objectively wrong for all people at all times. Whether I like it or not, whether it works for me or not, whether it works for society or not, it's wrong. It's the unjust taking of innocent human life. If it's not objectively wrong, it's not wrong at all. It's not the kind of wrong that can be wrong for me, but good for you. It's not like apples or bacon or chocolate. Either they are innocent human beings that are being unjustly destroyed through elective abortion, or they are nothing, and the process is no different than a tooth extraction. But if they are innocent human beings, it's wrong for all people at all times for us to do this for elective reasons. Okay, so now let's move on. Those are two mistakes that people make. I need to, for time's sake, I need to move on to making my case now. And so how do I make my case? I said I use science and philosophy because I don't want to start with my faith. I don't want to begin at the place where I'm going to immediately be categorized as subjective. When I was at Harvard, Harvard Hall was full. It's a smaller room. I mean, it's not a huge room, but it was full. And I had the opportunity to present my case. And I didn't talk about Psalm 139. And I didn't talk about Jeremiah. And I didn't talk about John the Baptist leaping in his womb, his mother's womb. I didn't talk about all the scriptures that I would normally point to as a Christian that may inform me or influence how I understand the world, but have nothing to do with the audience that I'm talking to as far as I know, because it would immediately said that is subjective, that is personal. And now, even if I want to argue that it's not subjective, my presentation is going to turn into a defense of the Bible and a defense of the Christian faith. And that's not why I'm there. Although I believe both of those things can be done rather well, that's not the point of my talk that night. So I start with science and philosophy. So science. The science of embryology tells us that after the completion of the fertilization process, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. Now, you may not be aware of this, but there is almost no pro-choice advocate anywhere in the world that will argue against what I just said. This is fairly uncontroversial. Science gives us the ability to identify what kind of organism has come into existence. That's what it's doing for us here. And from the moment that it comes into existence, when it is a single cell, it is a human organism, whole, distinct, and living. It is whole. It is not a part of anything else. It is not a constituent part of the mother working to for the benefit of her whole. It is its own whole, working for its own benefit and its own distinct, internally coordinated development. It is distinct from its mother and father and different from any cell in their body. Their parts gave up themselves. Their sperm, their egg, gave up themselves to serve the purpose of creating this new whole, different from either one of them. They're whole, distinct, and they're living. They metabolize. They have cellular reproduction, which means they grow and they respond to stimuli. They meet every single criteria from the moment that they come into existence to be considered a living organism. They're whole, distinct, and living organisms. And almost nobody on the other side argues against that. As a matter of fact, Peter Singer, one of the most famous pro-choice ethicists on the planet, says in his book, Practical Ethics, it is possible to give human being a precise meaning. We can use it as equivalent to member of the species Homo sapiens. Whether a being is a member of a given species is something that can be determined scientifically by an examination of the nature of the chromosomes in the cells of living organisms. In this sense, there is no doubt that from the first moments of its existence, an embryo conceived from human sperm and eggs is a human being. Dr. Michelin Matthews Roth from Harvard Medical School says, so therefore it is scientifically correct to say that an individual human life begins at conception when egg and sperm join to form the zygote, and this developing human always is a member of our species in all stages of its life. I used to carry 8 pages of quotes from pro-choice advocates, pro-choice philosophers, embryology textbooks, legal books, all of them saying exactly what I just said to you. It is uncontroversially true that human life begins at that moment. A new organism has come into existence. Ronald Dworkin, one of the most famous pro-choice legal philosophers of the last 100 years, wrote in his book, Life's Dominion, a defense of abortion, that it is unquestionably, abortion is unquestionably a choice for death and the death of a human life. This isn't even an arguable position. This is so easy to understand that a few years ago, we're sitting around the dinner table, and my son, at that time, my 10-year-old son, my 8-year-old daughter, I know, 10-year-old son, 8-year-old daughter, and 4-year-old daughter are all sitting around the dinner table, and suddenly my son says, "Hey, Mom, did you know that inside the woman's body, there's a cell called an egg, and inside the man's body, there's a cell called a sperm? And when these two things get together," and he does like his fingers like that, I'm like, what is he doing? He's like, "That's where human life comes from." And my wife shoots me a look like this is somehow my fault that my son's talking about this. I have no idea why the kid's talking about this at dinner. And so she says, "Yes, Peyton, I did know that, but how do you know that?" And he said, "Well, I was in Daddy's study section, and there was an anatomy book on the shelf. And so I pulled that out, and I looked through it, and I said, I read that. I thought that was just fascinating." And he says this, he's like, "I don't want you guys to worry about it, though, because it only happens like once a month, so it's not happening all the time or anything." We're like, "Woo, thanks, buddy. Appreciate the, you know, we were really worried for a second there, but you helped us out." My 10-year-old son read it in an anatomy book, not a Christian anatomy book, not a pro-life anatomy, just an anatomy book. So if the science is agreed in the sense that it is a human organism, then what is the argument about? The argument is about, does it matter? And that's not a science question. That's a philosophical question. We have to leave science behind. It's done its job. It's identified what the organism is. It's a human organism, whole, distinct, and living, differentiated from its mother and its father in every way, just geographically located inside the mother for a time being in this developmental part of its process. But now we move on to that. So what, does it matter? Does it have value? So how do we determine that? How do we get down to that, ask that question? What's your name, sir? I'm sorry?
Sam.
Sam? Sam, would you help me out for a second? All right, Sam, stand up, please. Okay, Sam represents the radical pro-choice guy I'm talking to on campus. And so I have to talk to Sam, all right, and I have to determine where does Sam and I agree or disagree on things very quickly, because we got to get to the meat of our conversation. And so I asked Sam what we call a diagnostic question. This question is designed or intended for me to get as much information as I can out of Sam in a very short amount of time so that we can move on with this discussion. And so here's the question. Given what I've already discussed about the difference between objective and subjective, okay, would it be objectively wrong, Sam, for me to kill you right now?
No.
Ah! Sam is a moral subjectivist. You don't think it would be wrong to kill you right now. Okay, well, this is interesting because what Sam has done is Sam has taken the abortion issue off the table altogether. There's no reason to try to convince Sam that it's wrong to kill him because he doesn't, or to kill the unborn because he doesn't think it's wrong to kill anybody. Now, Sam, I don't have time to go into all of the crazy implications for the worldview that you're espousing right now. Needless to say, I once was like you, and that it is an unlivable and unsustainable worldview, but that's a different conversation altogether. This is important, though. It's important because if I sit here talking to Sam for 30 minutes trying to convince him it's wrong to have abortions, and he doesn't think anything's objectively wrong, he thinks everything is subjectively determined, I've just wasted my entire time. Because what Sam needs to do is evaluate his worldview and the difference between whose worldview best explains the data of the world that we exist in. I would argue that Sam's worldview cannot hold ultimately between the world that we exist in. But that's a different conversation that we don't have time for right now. So Sam, I appreciate you, but please sit down. Would somebody raise their hand if they think that it would be objectively wrong for me to kill Sam? I want somebody to fight for Sam's life. All right, there you go. That guy back there thinks I shouldn't kill you. So you should talk to him because he's a good guy. All right, so now we have to ask this question. Why? Let's say you're an abortion supporter too, but unlike Sam, you think it would be wrong for me to kill Sam. You're like, don't kill Sam. I like Sam. He's a good guy. But that would be objectively wrong too. It would be the wrong thing to do. What's your name, sir? Josh? Okay, so now I have to ask you, what changed? Okay. You think that abortion's okay. I'm not saying you do, but for the sake of this discussion, you think abortion is okay, but you don't think I should kill Sam. So what changed about Sam? What changed from Sam when Sam was an embryo or a fetus to the young man that's standing in front of me right now? That if I killed Sam when he was an embryo or a fetus, it would be perfectly okay within the worldview that people are arguing when they're talking about abortion, but that if I killed Sam, even though he doesn't think it's wrong, most people agree it would be the bad thing to do, right? So what changed? Now you don't have to answer that. And you can answer it later, because we don't have time to go into a big discussion now because I had to talk to Sam. So the answer, though, is one of the answers you're going to offer me are size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency. Those are one of those four. That was given to us by philosopher Stephen Schwartz. It's called the SLED acronym. Size, level of development, environment, or degree of dependency. If we argue that it is objectively wrong to kill innocent human beings, which most people do, then we have to determine what's the difference between the human being that I think it's objectively wrong to kill and what's the difference between the human life that I say it's okay to kill. And the differences will be size, level, development, environment, or degree of dependency. And we argue that none of those do the philosophical work necessary to say that it was okay to kill you then, but it is wrong to kill you now. That it would be an objectively wrong thing to do now. They're not the kind of things that give value. Size, you're a different size, but size is what we call a degreed property. You have a little bit of it now, more of it later. When you're very small, you have a little bit of it. As you grow and progress in your size, you gain more. Your size changes all throughout the course of your life. But if such a thing as universal human value is true, if it makes sense to look at things going around the world right now, if we look at what happened in Kenya, we look at what happened with ISIS and what they're doing, if we look at all these different places and want to say that outside of any cultural influences, outside of the personal motivations of those people, people ought not to be treated that way. We have to have some grounds on which to place that determination, some value that human life has that is not a part of their culture, that is not a part of the personal people that are making those subjective decisions. Something that transcends that culture and that transcends the world and the feelings in which they live, that says that even though everything in your body tells you that you should be allowed to slaughter that village, that's wrong and that should be stopped. We have to have something that explains why, even though there are people out there right now raping women because they're a Christian or raping women because they're Muslim or raping women just because they have no value to human life, that that is wrong and human beings should not be treated like that no matter what culture you grow up in, no matter what your belief system is. That's wrong. And whatever that thing is that transcends all of it, we all have equal amounts of. And so something like size is going to be a difficult place to ground it because size doesn't come with equal amounts. If we had everybody in this room stand up, you'd see big people, you'd be small people, with all different sized people. I'm not gonna ask you to do that because we don't have time, but you wouldn't look at the small people hopefully and think, oh my gosh, look at that poor small person, they have so little value. They're little value, their little bodies just can't hold value. And you wouldn't look at the big people and be like, man, look at that guy, he's huge, he's very valuable. Because we don't understand value coming like that. But most of all, most people are gonna argue level of development. That's where most of the arguments are going to go. Size, level of development. They're going to say level of development is where you get value from. It is necessary for you to be able to do something, to pass some developmental threshold, some ability to be immediately practicable, for you to be considered a person. They'll say human beings in and of themselves don't have value. Persons have value. And we can draw a line through every human life from beginning to end and say that at this point, you cease to be merely human and you became a person. And persons have rights. We have obligations and duties to other persons. We do not have obligations and duties to human beings. And then we're going to draw that line all over the place because they don't agree on where it should be drawn. And they argue about it constantly. But all of them seem to believe that it makes sense to draw a line through humanity and say those people matter and those basic humans do not. Heartbeat, ability to feel pain, organized cortical brain activity, just the impact of brain waves altogether, sentience, rational thought, capacities, birth, all of these things are differently. I hear more than anything, conscious awareness that you exist. That's the argument you hear mostly on college campuses. Conscious awareness that you exist offers you value. That's where you get value from. Now, here's the problem. Conscious awareness that we exist doesn't come, depending on how you define it, until at least months after you're born. And sometimes as much as 2 years after you're born, depending on how they're going to define it. So we have philosophers, Peter Singer, who I mentioned earlier, Michael Tooley, Jeff McMahon, present-day philosophers that are going around trying to convince medical professionals, even in the Journal of Medical Ethics, an issue that came out recently in the last couple months, that we should consider what's called afterbirth abortions. You should be allowed to take your kids home if something happens within the first couple months of life, some genetic abnormality shows up, your circumstances change, you don't want that child, take it back to the hospital and have it painlessly and mercifully killed. And since the whole world loves abortion but hates infanticide, we'll call it afterbirth abortion instead of infanticide to make it go down a little easier. There's one article and one issue, then a whole issue was dedicated to that months later. Half the philosophers in that issue argued for this position. The other half did not. The other half said that we shouldn't do that. Only Robert George, Catholic philosopher, one of my personal heroes, said, this is madness. This is madness. You are advising doctors in the Journal of Medical Ethics, and not an academic journal that's released from everything. This is something where you're directly telling doctors as part of their medical practice that we should be free to kill newborn human beings. This is madness. But Peter Singer responds, it's not madness, it's consistency. If we're allowed to kill the unborn right there inside the womb, then we should be allowed to kill them when they're born. That gets us to E, size, level, development, environment. He says, because where they are does not determine what they are. So if I can kill them here, 8 inches down the birth canal, I didn't magically transform them into the kind of thing that I can't kill. If they're the kind of thing that we can kill there, they're the kind of thing that we can kill here because they are the exact same kind of thing no matter where they are. It's what they are that gives them value, Singer argues, what they can do that gives them value, not where they are. And he's right. I agree with him. I disagree with him that consciousness is the thing that we need to have in order to have value. I argue for an inclusive view of human value, that all human beings are valuable by virtue of what they are, not what they can do. But he's absolutely right. Being inside the womb or being outside the womb or being taken outside the womb to have prenatal surgery done or being found in vitro fertilization and being fertilized and come into existence in a dish and then later being put inside of a woman. None of these things, as far as where your location determines what you are. What you are is what determines whether or not you have value, not where you are. And finally, degree of dependence. They'll say that we have this radical dependence on the mother. But we don't look at other people and say, you are degree of dependence. Because it says degree, not dependence, degree of dependence, because we're all dependent on our culture. All of us need people around us. And so the degree of dependence is what makes us valuable. There's some threshold that we cross. We're so dependent that we're losing value and that it's okay to kill us. My daughter, who I mentioned earlier, the 10-year-old, MJ, she's a type 1 diabetic. She was diagnosed at 8 years old. One day she was radically independent. The next day she was medically dependent on insulin for the rest of her life, dependent on her family to help her figure out every meal. Her dependence grew monstrously in the course of a 24-hour period. Hopefully you don't believe she became something that it was a lesser offense to kill. As our elderly grow older, as my grandmother got older, she became very dependent. We never had a conversation considering whether or not we should kill her in her 90s as her dependence grew. As a matter of fact, as Christians, we are taught that those who are most dependent are the ones that God has called us most to take care of and to love. We are not free to dispose of them, but James chapter 1 tells us that pure religion is that which takes care of the widows and orphans and remains undefiled from the world. He says, far from thinking that they have become something that you can destroy, their very inability to take care of themselves makes them something you must take up the mantle to protect. Dependence does not mean you have less value, no matter what degree of which you have. And so finally, I want to get to, really quickly, honoring Christ and how we talk about things. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependence, they don't do the philosophical work necessary to disqualify that life as something of value, to say that we should be able to kill it then, but we can't kill it now. But when I have this argument, when I have this discussion with people, I have to be gracious. You have to be, and you can be. How can we go out in the world and tell everybody that I fight for the idea that all human beings have value, that there's a shared dignity that all human beings have, that we have responsibilities and duties and obligations to all human life from the moment that it comes into existence to the time that he dies, and at the same time hate the people who disagree with me? That would make me a terrible hypocrite. And so I have to find some way to have this conversation in a way that unites us, and since at least we can talk to each other. And it can work. When I was at Chapel Hill, I talked for 4 hours to all these people, and finally at the end of that 4 hours, this young lady was waiting to stand and she'd been watching the whole time. She said, can I talk to you for a second? I said, yeah, sure. She said, I am the head of the pro-choice group, the student pro-choice group here on campus, and I've been watching for 4 hours. By the way, they did not do well in that day. I don't mean this immodestly, but I mean, I'm a professional arguer. I mean, that's my job. And so college students aren't going to do very well against me, but it wasn't supposed to be a win-lose thing. It was an open dialogue discussion. And so as I was talking to them, I said, okay, she said, I watched you for the last 4 hours and I thought she was getting ready to jump on my case because her side wasn't doing well. And she said this to me. She said, I just wanted to wait all of this time to say thank you. Thank you for coming to our campus and talking about this. She said, every time we try to have some sort of conversation on this campus about this issue, it gets so ugly and people hate each other and there's yelling and screaming. She says, for 4 hours, y'all have been talking to each other and respecting each other and listening to each other. And it was beautiful. And I said, look, I'm a hugger. And don't worry, I'm not going to try to hug you if you're not. Don't freak out, because hugging non-huggers is like hugging some weird tree. But I was like, I'm a hugger. I said, are you a hugger? And she said, yeah, I am. I was like, let's hug this out. So we got a big hug. It's like, look, we have a profound disagreement. A profound disagreement about the value of human life. But we will never get to the bottom of it if we don't talk to each other, if we don't hear each other, if we don't listen to each other. I was once a terrible human being.
I wasn't just an atheist. I don't think atheists are terrible human beings, by the way. I'm not arguing that. I was a terrible human being when I was an atheist. I was an awful human being. I don't need you to make me feel bad about it. I already feel awful about the man that I was. And I have no interest in making anybody else feel badly about the choices that they've made in life. But I have to stand against something so objectively important. If all of the best arguments tell me that the unborn have value, so I need to do it in a way that honors Christ. I need to reach out with the same gospel that changed me, transformed me, and offer them the same chance to get right. Not through judgment or hatred or something divisive, but by opening up the altar and saying, you have the opportunity to get right. Recognize that what you did was wrong, and that what we're doing as a culture is wrong, and that what we're doing in the world on this issue is wrong, deeply wrong. But we have the opportunity to get right. We can do this in a way that honors people. Let's bow our heads. Heavenly Father, thank you for the grace and mercy that you offer us. I pray, God, that you just bless us. As we go forth for the rest of the day, I pray that questions have the opportunity to be answered, challenges have the opportunity to be raised. I pray that tonight's debate gives a demonstration of open dialogue on this that respects both sides and both opinions and both positions. But I pray mostly, God, that at this point, for all of those people who have never thought about this issue deeply, that they begin to consider it. They begin to consider the importance of this issue, no matter where they stand, and grow a desire to confront it. I pray, God, that we as a culture realize what we're doing when we start to draw lines. As Christopher Kaiser said, we've drawn lines before all throughout human history. We've all have a habit of saying that those people are human beings and those people are not. Those people are like me and they're not. And I pray, God, that we wake up and realize that every other time that we have said that those human beings are not like me, we've been wrong. We have morally matured and realized we should have never done the things that we're doing. I pray for that same moral maturity for our nation and our world today. The same maturity that we expressed over and over again on other issues, that we stop drawing lines between humanity and saying that those people are like me and those people are not, and we recognize our basic duty and obligations to love and take care of our fellow man. I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.